June 26, 2015 was one of the strangest days of my life. If you'll journey with me a moment or two, I'd like to tell you about it. So here goes. That morning, Sally's brother texted to tell us that our third nephew had been born. As I got the text, I was sitting in my office watching President Obama offer remarks from the Rose Garden. See, same-sex marriage had just become the law of the land that day. It turns out my brother-in-law, an attorney, was a leading member of an amicus brief filed in the Supreme Court case. So through tears, I know, surprise, I called him that morning to say thank you, first for my new nephew, and second for his efforts on the case. And as I talked to him and watched President and First Lady Obama wrap up at the Rose Garden, see, I knew where they were headed next. See, the president had more remarks to give that day, this time in Charleston, South Carolina. Today, he would also be offering the eulogy of Reverend Clemente Pinckney's funeral. If that name doesn't immediately ring a bell, Reverend Pinckney was a state senator and the pastor of Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston. He was murdered along with eight other congregants in the lower level of their sanctuary one night during a Wednesday night Bible study. As Obama traveled from D.C. to Charleston, I had a particularly challenging work day at Furman. I guess it was just kind of a day for both of us. I started the morning at... I didn't get to tell him about it, but... y'all can pass this on. I started the morning at a funeral for a student's mother. Truth is, I was processing so much that day that I hadn't even prepared myself for what kind of church I would be entering. See, the pastor, as he hovered over the casket from the pulpit to deliver the eulogy for this woman, decided in that moment to go on a tirade about America's moral decay regarding same-sex marriage. Remember, the morning. It was so bad, it was so jarring, it was so painful that I actually had to get up and walk out. That afternoon, I would be driving through a particularly rural part of South Carolina to visit another student whose brother had just tragically died. As I drove through these byways, I probably saw a dozen enormous, roaring pickup trucks with huge Confederate flags strapped to their beds, flailing and flying as they zoomed past me. I gripped the steering wheel. See, for easily more than a year, I couldn't get from my house to Furman's campus without seeing these flags every day, all over the city. Are you with me? As you may know, while Pinckney was being laid to rest, a debate in South Carolina was rising up about this flag flying over the state house. And I remember as I gripped that steering wheel while another flag flew past me and I listened to the president on the radio take that long pause and begin singing Amazing Grace. I wept, y'all, and wept, and I've already said it, I know I'm a crier, but this was different. This was one of those cries that felt like it was changing something inside of me, like I was the unseeing man in Mark's gospel, and Jesus had to try a second time to get me to see, to really see it all. Like those tears were clearing up my vision. See, the morning had started with the promise of life and love and joy, and then this strange, wearying, haunting, terrorizing violence just kept pressing in on it. It refused to just let the day be. Maybe this is what Moses felt like when he came down from Pharaoh's palace and saw his people being brutalized, destroyed, violated, exploited, and killed. Maybe after many years safe and unlabored among Egyptian royalty, this unexpected, jarring, hot anger and heartache were clearing up his vision too. I can't say that I knew much about Reverend Clemente Pinckney before he was murdered. But I'll tell you what I believe now. And honestly, I'll say it without an ounce of hesitation. His murderer did not just enter any old random space. Dylann Roof knew what he was doing. He knew exactly whose life he was ending. See, now I know that God had called Clemente Pinckney to be a vital leader and prophetic voice in the state of South Carolina, and I really believe soon enough the whole country, if we'd only known him. The more I've read about him, learned about him, listened to his voice in the years after his death, I'm convinced that the murderer's violence was deeply informed and intentional. This matters. He knew that Clemente Pinckney was going to help change the world. One of my favorite short clips of Reverend Pinckney is one of him giving a bit of a history lesson to a visiting group at Mother Emanuel AME Church, and he tells the history of the church. As he tells it, he also tells the story of a man named Denmark Vesey. Because you can't talk about Mother Emanuel AME Church without talking about Denmark Vesey. He says to this group gathered in that sacred space, in about 1822, there was an interesting minister in the church who was named Denmark Vesey. And Denmark Vesey planned an insurrection. It was planned so well that once the authorities found out about it, they had a little Guantanamo experiment. They took Denmark Vesey and all the conspirators they could find, and they interrogated them. And for years, they did not reveal the plan because they were afraid someone would pick it up and put the plan into action. And that was a minister here at the church. From the Denmark incident, the state of South Carolina got really concerned. And so out of that, we have the Military College of South Carolina. Does anybody know what that is? The Citadel. Does anybody know where the original site of the Citadel was? You actually passed it, he says to the group on Meeting Street. The Embassy Suites Hotel is the site of the old Citadel. The guns of the Citadel were basically facing this site, Mother Emanuel. And the community of African Americans living in this area, and that's how the Citadel got started. After this, South Carolina instituted a law that closed Mother Emanuel by state law, along with others, and it was about 40 years before the church was reestablished, and the year it was reestablished was the end of the Civil War. In 1963, when the Civil War was really turning, missionaries from Baltimore came down to reestablish the church. But before they could get started, they had to get permission from the military garrison to reopen it. The history of our church, not our church, Clemente Pinckney's church, and many churches in the area follow government policy. State policy and federal policy was closing and reestablishing a church, something that hasn't happened, he finishes by saying, since the Holy Roman Empire. I remember first watching this clip in the middle of one of my many sleepless nights after the shooting at Mother Emanuel. I've seen it dozens of times now, always looking for a new word in it as I do. What did it feel like for a church to have an entire military college built in order to have guns facing it? How do people survive state surveillance like that? When they know that the state wants nothing more and nothing less than their destruction. I wonder, what did it feel like for Moses to witness this lashing, this violation of humanity, the violation of his people right before his eyes? It must have felt like fear. Howard Thurman puts it this way in Jesus and the Disinherited. I'll read to you something Sally and I read our very first sermon here at Calvary, 3 years ago now. Fear is one of the persistent hounds of hell that dog the footsteps of the poor, the dispossessed, the disinherited. There is nothing new or recent about fear. It is doubtless as old as the life of humans on the planet. Fear are of many kinds. Fear of objects, fear of people, fear of the future, fear of nature, fear of the unknown, fear of old age, fear of disease, fear of life itself. The ever-present fear that besets the vast poor, the economically and socially insecure, is a fear of still a different breed. It is like the fog in San Francisco or in London. It has its roots deep in the heart of the relations between the weak and the strong, between the controllers of environment and those who are controlled by it. This is the kind of fear Denmark Vesey would have ingested every day of his life. A man who witnessed the atrocities of slave labor first in Barbados and then in Charleston. Honestly, things that are too gruesome for words. Oppression so thick it carried the stench of death everywhere it went. And it is out of a palpable relationship to this reality. It is the collective embodied response to these hounds, as Thurman calls them, that forges and fortifies the origins of Black religion in America and Black creativity in America and Black imagination in America and Black power in America and Black hope in America and Black life in America. It is a framework that cannot help but call the hounds what they are. It is a framework that invites us to call the hounds what they are. This, among many things, is the profound, unblinding, visionary, clarifying gift Black religion in America gives us. See, housing policy that does not prioritize the needs of the poor and dispossessed is a hound. A criminal justice system that disproportionately incarcerates Black and brown people is a hound. The lie this country is telling at the border is a hound. And our history proves to us that we have a long lineage of hounds. Injecting fear into the dispossessed to keep them subservient, to keep them in place, to keep them from ever fighting back with the agency and power that God gives every living being. Vesey and Moses responded to that fear with insurrection. They went as far as they knew to go to deliver their people from bondage. And as the story of Exodus keeps revealing to us, God goes pretty far too. All the way to the other side of the Red Sea, where as the old spiritual sings to us, Pharaoh's army got drowned. See, God does not, cannot ignore the hounds. Cannot ignore the root of violence. And God sees and remembers the strange fruit that it yields. God is profoundly affected by the sighs and groans of a terrorized people. And we must be profoundly affected by them too. We must be a community that emphasizes where the root of the violence is. Where the rotting, vile root of the violence is. Wherever it is to be found. In whatever manifestation it finds itself. I'm pretty open, y'all. We must be a community that looks back on history and calls slavery itself the real war. So many Moseses have been snuffed out too soon. So many Moseses ready to lead their people to the promised land have been hounded by violence, by state violence or ideological violence or supremacy in all its wicked forms. Black theologian James Cone says that we must let black people seek their liberation on their own terms. This may unsettle us. Letting oppressed and dispossessed people say for themselves what they need, what is required to make things right and whole again. But I remember another man named Zacchaeus, who, when Jesus started telling him about the brokenhearted and violated people he loved, well, Zacchaeus couldn't help but want to give it back. Zacchaeus couldn't help but want to repair the harm. Y'all, I'm so grateful. If you haven't heard this, hear this today. I'm so grateful to pastor a church. I'm so grateful to pastor a church that wants to call out the hounds of hell that dog the footsteps of the dispossessed. I'm so grateful. I'm going to try one more time because I really want this to like go all the way in your bowels. I'm so grateful to pastor a church in America right now that wants to call out the hounds of hell that dog the footsteps of the dispossessed. I'm so grateful to pastor a church that feels the sadness and rage that Moses must have felt when one of his people was victimized by the hounds of violence. Because see, here's what excites me about this story. Are you ready? Here's what excites me about this story. About enslaved Americans finding themselves in the story of Exodus. See, if they could find themselves in God's story, if they could find themselves in God's story, when that story had been hidden from them, taken from them, twisted up for them, maligned by those who sought to oppress them, when they could find themselves in that story, if they could still miraculously discover that God helped the Israelites and God would help them too. Don't you think you can too? Wow. Don't you think you can too? Don't you think we can too? Don't you think God has a place for us, every one of us, in this story if we want to be a part of it? If you or your family fled political violence or social violence, whether it was communist or socialist or capitalist or anything in between, don't you know that you're in the story? If you are queer and you keep hearing from lots of loud voices that the Bible calls you sinner, let me tell you something. God's got another word for you in here, and it's beloved. You're in the story too. If you are weary, wounded, hurting from an experience of personal abuse or harassment or neglect, my God, you are in the story too. If you're trying to do right by the God of liberation as you make sense of your own privilege and life and story, yes, I don't care how hard it is for you to believe this, you're in the story too. You're in the story. See, if we could find ourselves in God's story, if they could find themselves in God's story, when everyone was telling them they did not belong in God's story, don't you think you can too? Black historian Vincent Harding said in his book, "There Is a River, The Black Struggle for Freedom in America," that at almost every meeting it was said Denmark Vesey or one of his comrades, quote, read to us from the Bible how the children of Israel were delivered out of Egypt from bondage. That theme was struck insistently. The deliverance from Egypt, the movement of God among God's captive people. No wonder then that in some Black tradition it was said that Vesey or his fellows were the inspiration for the ageless Black song of faith and struggle, "Go down, Moses. Go down, Moses. Way down in Egypt land. Hello, Pharaoh. Let my people go. Go down.